I'm Rich Egger, and this is In the Tri-States, a review of the news of the past month. On May 15th, we learned a former Macomb High School teacher and coach would be headed to jail. Public Radio's Jim Lenz has the story.
Daniel Watson pleaded guilty to a charge of official misconduct for having inappropriate communication with a student under 18 years of age. Watson and the victim exchanged over 6,000 texts over a three-month period. McDonough County State's Attorney James Hoyle says the result takes into account the crime and the stress to the victim.
It's a fair resolution given the balancing of interest that we had to do with our victim and wanting to move on with her life, the defendant's lack of criminal history, and the seriousness of the offense. I think it's a fair disposition. He'll never be a teacher again.
Watson faced a charge of aggravated criminal sexual abuse and two charges of official misconduct. Watson's plea prevents him from becoming a registered sex offender. Watson will serve up to 150 days in McDonough County Jail. He will be on probation for 30 months. He will have to pay a $4,000 fine. I'm Jim Lenz.
A few days later, a former Hamilton School Board member managed to avoid prison despite his conviction for felony sexual abuse involving a minor. Dion Gregory will instead serve 2 months in the Hancock County Jail and 2 years of supervised probation. Gregory's sentencing hearing included impact statements from his wife and from the victim, who is a male juvenile. Gregory said he regretted the impact of his actions on the victim. Also in mid-May, a Burlington man was sentenced to 10 years in prison for setting fires that damaged the Union Baptist Church last year. At the time of the fires, 45-year-old Victor Clegg Jr. was still on probation for a 2009 arson conviction in Michigan. In the early morning hours of May 19th, 4 people were killed when 2 boats slammed into each other on the Mississippi River near Burlington. Matthew House, Jacob Boyd, Caitlin Atchley, and Blake Eakins were all in their early 20s. They were all from Burlington. Investigators say it was a nearly head-on collision. The 2 small fishing boats were shuttling partiers from an island to shore. Keokuk's top cop is calling it a career. Public Radio's Jason Parrott tells us the announcement was made on May 17th and that July 6th will be the final day on the job for Tom Crew.
He has been with the department for 25 years, serving as patrol officer, captain, and assistant chief along the way. Crew has led the department for the last 7 years. He says it is time for him to leave the world of law enforcement.
The department's in good stead right now, and there's no major fires burning or anything else. And I thought, they're not looking to cut our department, and they're replacing personnel. And I just felt it was a good time.
Crew says his most memorable case involved a methamphetamine distribution ring that stretched across several states as well as Mexico. I'm Jason Parrott.
Keokuk is also losing its school superintendent. Dr. Laura Wolf announced last month that she will take a teaching position in Western Illinois University's Educational Leadership Department. She's been with the Keokuk School District for more than 28 years. The school board agreed to pay $6,500 to a search firm to help it select the next superintendent. The board hopes to have that person in place before school starts this fall. Construction could soon begin on a large-scale hog farm in northwestern McDonough County. Public Radio's Jim Lenz is back with this report filed on May 30th.
The Illinois Ag Department granted a permit for South Morgan Acres. Barbara Adams fought against the permit. She says news that it was granted made her sick to her stomach.
We've got the one a mile away from us that affects us sometimes. And this one will be a lot closer than a mile to the south.
Adams and her husband are considering moving from the home where they've lived for the last 34 years. Professional swine management will run the farm. PSM's Doug Groth says it will not bother those who live nearby.
The location we picked there is very suitable with a very good tree cover around the facility, and that helps block prevailing winds and help control, odor disbursement.
South Morgan Acres will be home to up to 6,000 adult hogs and up to 12,000 suckling piglets. I'm Jim Lenz. Thank you.
Illinois legislators adjourned their spring session without taking action to alleviate the state's ballooning pension debt. As Public Radio's Amanda Vinicky reports, that means they'll likely be back at the Capitol this summer to try again.
With the nation's worst-funded pension system, there's heavy pressure on Illinois lawmakers to find savings.
I really believe everyone understands this has to be done. It absolutely has to be done.
That's Senate Republican leader Christine Rodonio, who says she's encouraged the Senate approved a measure that would leave legislators and state employees with smaller pensions. Despite suggestions, the vote was symbolic. Senate President John Cullerton says it's the real deal.
Because I believe this is going to become the law.
The legislation does not affect public school teachers and university employees' retirement benefits. That's because there's a largely partisan divide over whether the state or schools should pick up the tab for those workers' benefits. The schism prevented the House from passing a broader pension package. In a statement, Governor Pat Quinn said the pension system is drowning in an ocean of unfunded liability, so inaction is not a choice, a signal that legislators will be called into special session to deal with it. I'm Amanda Vinicky.
The Tea Party and Occupy movements could both be considered forms of political activism, but a civil rights leader from Western Illinois says the two movements could not be more different, and not just because of their politics. Reverend C.T. Vivian was a close friend of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. He worked alongside King during the American Civil Rights Movement, so he knows a thing or two about political activism. Vivian says the only way the world changes is when the people get involved.
And if you're going to make a difference, or if a difference is going to be made in the world, it's only going to be made in relationship to the numbers of people that take life serious enough and take what they consider as right and wrong serious enough to live by it. And in the living by it, I don't mean listening to it. I mean doing something to make it real. Church is all right for Sunday morning, and I'm a minister, so, you know, I'm not throwing against church. Church is basic to me and molded me. It molds most people in their sense of what's right and wrong. The problem is that to mold you and you sit there isn't enough, because you're really going to learn what the faith is in the action, in the street, in the doing. It's not going to come in the listening.
And we've seen some of that in the past year or so with the Occupy movement.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
I am so glad that somebody's started a people's movement. Now, I think that they haven't been as effective as they could be, thinking about our own movement that was tremendously effective, all right, until the only non-president on the American Mall happens to be Dr. King, all right? They need a spokesman for the organization. They need a theme to go after each one of the things that they're after, right? That they need a unity of purpose across the nation, right? They have the potential of making tremendous change, but in terms of people's movements, because that's what we're talking about, right? Is that they can be more effective in all the legislation if they really organize and reach the conscience of the people. Now, they're reaching it less and less over the weeks and years, right? Martin King used to say it's a 10-day nation. If you haven't done something that reaches towards your goal that people can see and know in 10 days, they forget you exist.
Right. Is it too late for them to do that,
oh, no.
Or is there time?
It's never too late to have a people's movement, because they have to all switch around in the beginning until they get the train moving.
What about the Tea Party movement? Do you see that as being similar with a different agenda, but is it the same type of thing?
No, not at all. In fact, the Tea Party as we see it is more a hindrance than a help to average people, and that's where it counts.
Why is it more of a hindrance?
It is because it's based on when one of their members spits on a black congressman, you know what I think, right? And when I see them, I see them as a backward movement, not a forward one, right? See that there's their base your values, right? Good and bad. There are negative values and there are positive values, right? But I'd hate to see them become a dominant American movement. I don't think that way about Republicans. I think that way about them.
Dr. C.T. Vivian turns 88 in late July, but he does not appear to be slowing down. He's currently national president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he's involved with several other projects. Vivian was just back in his hometown of Macomb in mid-May to speak at the annual Dealing with Difference Institute at Western Illinois University. There was a time when pencils, paper, and chalkboards were classroom norms. Today, there are schools where the kids use laptops or iPads at their desks, while the teachers use interactive smart boards. To keep up, new state-of-the-art schools are being built that can take advantage of the latest technology and other advancements. But in their wake are the old brick buildings so many of us grew up in. As the school year wound down at the end of May, Public Radio's Jason Parrott told us about four such buildings in southeast Iowa that will no longer be used to teach our future leaders.
Tracy Hardis was not going to give her second grade students a pass just because the school year was coming to an end in Keokuk. They had a spelling test to take, and she was going to make sure they were ready by playing a game of Sparkle. The rules of Sparkle are simple. Students sit on their desks and take turns spelling words one letter at a time. Miss a letter, you take a seat. After a word is completed, the next student says Sparkle, which means the following student must also take a seat. The last student sitting on his or her desk receives a victory cookie. Tracy Hardis says these are the types of memories she will take with her when she walks out of Keokuk's Wells Carey Elementary for the final time.
You know, we have a lot of fun together. We dance and sing and do a lot of learning games and just see them have fun learning.
After more than 85 years of dancing and singing and learning, Wells Carey is being closed due to declining enrollments in the Keokuk School District. Hardis has worked at the school for 16 years as an associate and as a teacher. She says the closing is tough because the school is like a second home and her coworkers are like family.
I wouldn't have wanted to go anywhere else. That's why I've stayed. We have a really tight staff. We hang out together after school. We're really good friends. We all take care of each other.
Several weeks ago, Hardis started packing up the classroom materials she was not using. That was also when she started giving her students some of the items she would not be taking with her when she moves to Hawthorne Elementary next year.
We've already had some tears. Just thinking that, you know, some of these kids we won't even see again. I mean, I will because I'll go to the same building, but there's people here that will never see these kids again, where you've always known you're coming back the next year and you'll see them again.
Most of the staff from Wells Carey will go to either Hawthorne or George Washington Elementary. Superintendent Laura Wolf says the district initially considered renovating Wells Carey, but realized the cost would be too high due to its age and condition.
Buildings built in 1925 were not built for today's classrooms with technology, with the electrical demands. It's just an old building.
The least expensive option for the district was to add classrooms to Hawthorne, renovate George Washington, and close Wells Carey. By contrast, the Fort Madison School District decided a new school is the best option for replacing two aging buildings. Superintendent Ken Morang says Fort Madison Middle School has served the district well for decades, first as a high school and then as the middle school. But he says the building can no longer keep up with increased enrollments.
It is difficult now with 500 kids in there, you know, small rooms and narrow hallways, up and down convoluted stairways.
Morang says the other school set to close is Denmark Elementary. He says it, too, has served the district well, but, like the middle school, Denmark has deficiencies.
It's outdated. In a lot of ways, it's unsafe. The doors open out into the hallways. We got some mold out there. We got leaking there.
Morang says the new 4th through 8th grade school on the city's west side will be safer and more technology-friendly. He says the implementation of a statewide local option sales tax made it possible for the district to build the new school. The Burlington School District is also benefiting from that same tax, but that is not the reason why the district is replacing the soon-to-be-closed James Madison Middle School. Superintendent Jane Evans says the district is finishing up a new school initiative.
The previous school board started the Newer and Fewer project. At one time, there were 3 middle schools in Burlington and as many as 15 elementary schools.
Burlington will be down to 2 middle schools and 5 elementary schools with the pending completion of Edward Stone Middle School. James Madison is more than 50 years old, and Evans says it is not ideal for a modern middle school.
It has lower ceilings than the newer facilities. It's not air-conditioned throughout the building. Modern buildings will have technology already built in.
But James Madison Middle School will not sit vacant. The Burlington School District will use the building for its alternative high school, for food service, and for information technology starting in the fall. The future of Fort Madison Middle School, Denmark Elementary, and Wells Carey Elementary is not so certain because no specific use has been identified at this point. Second grade teacher Tracy Hardis hopes the Keokuk School District finds a positive, productive use for Wells Carey. She says she is getting used to the idea of leaving her second home for the last 16 years in favor of Hawthorne. In fact, she sees tremendous potential in the move for herself and for Kathleen Morgan, who also teaches second grade at Wells Carey.
We share ideas all day long, you know, and I got this for this lesson, and we just share back and forth. That's what's exciting to me, is that we're going to have all the second grade teachers, and we're all going to build on each other, and I think it's going to be powerful.
Hardis is also excited about the new opportunities for her students through improved technology and a larger parent-teacher organization. And that's the idea behind all of these new or renovated schools in Southeast Iowa, to make sure that students are fully prepared for what they face after graduation, which is why districts are looking to the future and the next generation of buildings instead of fighting to hold on to the past. I'm Jason Parrott.
Project Insight in Macomb is an alternative school. In other words, it's for junior and senior high schoolers who have behavioral problems. So you might think it would be impossible to get all 52 of those students working together to achieve a common goal. Not only would you be wrong, but you can see the result for yourself in a piece of public art.
Yay!
The mosaic was unveiled outside the school on a bright and warm spring day. Like the day, the mosaic itself is bright, full of shades of reds and blues and other vibrant colors. It's made of broken dishes combined with pieces of mirrors. They're laid out in a specific pattern.
It's geometrical, it's balanced on all sides, and it has a center, a middle ground, and an edge.
Which means it's a mandala, says Macomb-based artist Kelly Quinn, who came up with the design and oversaw the project. She says there's a purpose to the design of a mandala.
The actual process of looking at it, your eyes go through a certain pattern, and it promotes calmness and meditation. And they've been around for thousands of years.
This one was 6 to 8 weeks in the making. Project Insight students were involved every step of the way. The main part of this mandala measures 8 feet by 8 feet. Its border is made up of 36 smaller mandalas. Each of those was created by the students. One of those students is Rayetta Parker of Rushville, who has an interest in art.
I like to paint, and I like to create new things, like sculptures.
Do you think you'll try to do a mosaic like this again?
Oh, a million times. It's fun. And it what I love the most about it is everyone worked together. Everyone helped you. It wasn't a fighting thing to get done. It was, you know, can you hand me that? And they'd do it. It was just work together. And it's perfect, I think.
Principal Betsy Wiesack also thinks it's beautiful. She's talking not just about the mandala, but also about the way the students came together.
They used their artistic ability to, pursue a new avenue, a release for their stress, and gets their mind off of maybe what may not be going well in their lives.
Artist Kelly Quinn says she was honored to work with the students. She thinks they're talented, though she says they don't always realize what they have to offer. Quinn says the mandala gave them a chance to see a piece through from start to finish and experience the feeling of success.
Everybody found something they really enjoyed doing. Some people love gluing, some love cleaning, some love the design element. Everybody loved breaking the plates, which is, it's actually very liberating to break some of these plates.
Quinn is also impressed that Project Insight is willing to focus on the arts, especially at a time when the arts seem to be on the wane in public schools. Student Rayetta Parker is happy, too. She says it most definitely helped her to see how a professional artist goes about her business.
She has, like, this tickle inside of her head that goes there and that goes there. And after seeing this all together, it's amazing how you can combine so many different shapes and forms together.
Is there one particular thing you learned from her as an artist?
No matter how difficult it looks, if you stick with it, anything's possible.
This project was made possible by the Illinois Arts Council, which provided much of the funding for it. The artwork can be seen on the north wall of Project Insight, right along well-traveled West Adams Street. The street could see even more car, bicycle, and pedestrian traffic in coming years if the city follows through on its plans to enhance the West Adams corridor. Perhaps the mandala can be considered one of the first improvements to that corridor, a colorful bit of public art pieced together when Project Insight students came together and made it happen. On May 18th, we presented a feature tied into that day's observance of International Museum Day.
The mention of museums might get you thinking about large institutions in big cities, such as Chicago's Field Museum or the Museum of Modern Art in New York. But many small and rural towns have their own museums, and you just might learn something new when you pay them a visit. Today, we'll tell you about three such museums in the tri-states. Rich Egger starts us off in Beardstown, where the museum has something you won't find anywhere else in the world.
The old Lincoln Courtroom and Museum is a two-story red brick building. It's at the corner of 3rd and State on Beardstown Square, just a few blocks from the Illinois River. The building has housed City Hall, the Fire Department, and the Police Department during its long history. Today, it's divided into around a dozen rooms, each with a different theme. For example, Museum Commission Chair Paula Woods says there's a room dedicated to city founder Thomas Beard.
He settled here in 1819.
1819.
Plat of the town in 1829.
There are also rooms that document river life and other aspects of Beardstown's history. But to see the real prize, you have to head upstairs. This is something you can only see in Beardstown, and it cannot be loaned to another museum. Behind a set of big, thick wooden doors is the only courtroom used by Abraham Lincoln that's still in use today.
There are two floors underneath the one we're standing on, and an architectural historian says probably that the bottom one was the original, the one on which Lincoln walked.
This is the room where Lincoln argued one of his most famous cases. It's known as the Almanac Trial. Lincoln defended Duff Armstrong, who was the son of a family friend. Armstrong was accused of killing a man in neighboring Mason County. A witness for the prosecution swore he saw the murderous act by the light of the full moon.
Lincoln questioned him two or three times. He thought he would have caught on to making sure that he said, oh yes, he saw it by the light of the full moon. And then Lincoln produced the almanac, which showed that there was no full moon that night.
Armstrong was found not guilty. That trial happened in 1858. Today, most trials in Cass County are heard at the county courthouse in the town of Virginia. But Wood says this room is still used for some cases. Like many museums, this one has a gift shop. It sells many Lincoln-related goods, including Lincoln logs. That brings us to our second museum, which is housed in an old log cabin. Jim Lenz tells us about it.
It's a work day at the future home of the North Adams Historical Society. Rosemary Tenvoort has waited 40 years to hear this sound. It took that long for her to generate enough interest in restoring the cabin, which will also serve as a museum. The cabin even has a new home on a donated lot along Highway 96 just south of Ursa. It's a more prominent and accessible location than its previous home, a quarter mile back from the highway. Tenvoort says moving the 50-ton structure such a short distance required a lowboy and every hydraulic jack in town.
We had to take all the clapboard off and bear it down to the logs,
And inside we took out the plaster lath, and bared it down to the logs on the inside to get rid of weight.
Volunteers are spending most of their time replacing the chinking, which is a sealant material applied between the logs. Tenvoort has been working inside the cabin, removing nails by the hundreds. These are not the standard uniform nails of today, as each was handmade, so no two are exactly alike. She also found an unexpected treasure along the way, wallpaper from the 1920s.
It looks like kind of an Art Deco wall in the making right now, and I don't know if we're going to keep it. I'd hope that they would, just because it is Art Deco.
Tenvoort says the use of Art Deco wallpaper can be explained by the fact that the cabin was still being used until 1963. This project holds a special place in Tenvoort's heart. That's because her great-grandparents built the cabin in 1848. Tenvoort says William and Susan Smith divided the upper floor of the cabin for their children's bedrooms. She says the girls stayed in the larger room. They also had the luxury of having a row of hooks so they could hang their clothes. An addition to the cabin was built along the way, with the hired hands staying in its upper floor. Tenvoort says one of them was named Jim. He was a former slave.
But he's must have been very important because he's listed on the birth page in the family Bible.
The addition will be reattached later in the year. The rooms where the children of William and Susan Smith stayed will be a featured display when the museum opens next spring. Volunteers expect to be working right up to the opening date to turn an aging log cabin into a brand new museum. The final stop in our tour takes us across the Mississippi River. Jason Parra tells us about a museum in Keokuk where the actual structure is just as historic as its contents.
The George M. Verity Riverboat Museum still looks pretty good for being 85 years old, especially after spending 30-plus years traveling up and down the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. The giant steamboat's white exterior remains relatively sharp, with just a hint of faded yellow stains. The black smokestacks and lettering stand out against the green frame doors and windows. The museum's main office is filled with photographs that tell its history. Museum Commission Chairman Chuck Peicher says several show how the floods of 1993 and 2008 turned the steamboat's former home into its worst enemy.
Anytime you have a flood on the Mississippi, you have a lot of mud, as well as paint popping off of steel because the water gets behind it and that kind of stuff. So it's a significant cleanup.
The George M. Verity started out as the SS Thorpe. It was built in Dubuque, Iowa in 1927 to move freight on the Mississippi River. Peicher says a subsequent owner, Armco Steel, retired it in 1960 in favor of its diesel-powered boats.
In the end, the citizens of Keokuk persuaded them to donate the boat to Keokuk for a dollar.
Peicher says they wanted it to be a museum. He says it was floated to its current riverfront location during a period of high water shortly after its retirement. Peicher says visitors can walk through it and see what it was like to be on a steamboat.
All of the machinery on the main deck is still here, the engines, the boilers, and all the auxiliary machinery, and on the upper decks is living space for the crew.
The George M. Verity Riverboat Museum is not yet open for the season due to the need for some roof repairs. But once it does, it will provide visitors from around the world a glimpse into life on the mighty Mississippi some 50 years ago. In fact, each of the three small museums we heard about today take visitors back to a time without iPads, cable television, or the internet. They also show how a museum is about the stories it contains, not its square footage or the number of exhibits it holds. I'm Jason Parrott.
That concludes In the Tri-States. Thanks to Jason Parrott, Jim Lenz, and Amanda Vinicky for their contributions. For Tri-States Public Radio News, I'm Rich Ecker.